to me. Talk to me.
I love the things you say. Talk to me. Talk to me in your own special way. Welcome New Mexico, around the country and around the world. If you're listening, you are tuning into Dialogue, where we are changing the conversation. That's right. And joining me today, I have two fabulous people. And you know what? Maybe I will just allow you to introduce yourselves. Would that be all right? Gail, would you like to go first?
I would certainly be happy to introduce myself. Yes. I'm Gail Mariner. I am the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation here in Santa Fe. And with me is...
George Weston. And full disclosure, Gail is my minister, and I also work here at KSFR.
Very good. And guess what we are talking about today, folks? We are going to be taking on the topic of white male privilege. That's right. And I'm going to add to that white male upper class privilege. And what there's a new term that's out there being used called intersectionality. And the guests here are going to help us understand what that means. But I also brought George on specifically because he is a white man. And I believe of privilege enough to say that you would fit the mold. Would that be right? If there is such a thing,
I benefit from many privileges, and one of them is being white, and one of them is being male, one of them is having been born in this country, one of them is having been born to well-educated parents, one of them is having been well-educated myself. The list of my privileges is very extensive, and I only started thinking about this later in life, after I had retired and maybe had the time to. So we'll get into this a little more, but one of the big problems with privilege is the concept of transparency of privilege, and that is many times those that have privilege don't realize the privileges that they have.
I think that's true. We're enculturated, those of us with privilege, and I have a fair amount of privilege myself. I mean, I got to go to Harvard Divinity School, which puts me in the educational 1%. I'm a blue-eyed blonde. That's also something that our culture often sees as desirable. And there are a whole network of things that George and I would both take for granted in the way we move in the world, in the way people will trust us without asking a whole lot of questions, in the ways that people might confide in us, that really have very little to do with our efforts as individuals.
Right.
And it's fascinating because those different kinds of privileges intersect, and in the places they intersect, they kind of have a multiplying effect.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Let's go further into that, because you tell us first what intersectionality actually is. How do you define it? And then what happens? I love your metaphor of strings.
Yeah.
And if you can talk about that, that would be great. And we are, I do want to let the audience know, we're going to open up the phone lines in about the second half hour. We
cool.
want to get the conversation going, yeah, to get
cool.
some audience feedback in on this.
So yeah. It's really important to acknowledge that Kimberly Williams Crenshaw is the person who coined the phrase intersectionality back in 1989. And she did it because she was talking about the ways that black women's experiences intersected, so that the kinds of prejudice and oppression that came from being black and the kinds of prejudice and oppression that they experienced being female behaved in a really curious way. They both multiplied the intensity of the impression, and they obscured what was visible to the outside world. So for these women, there was a case of one woman who was trying to get a job at a manufacturing plant, which hired both women and men, but women could only work in the offices and men could only work out with the heavy equipment, and she was qualified to work with the heavy equipment. And so somehow the oppressive set of circumstances surrounding her became invisible, and the culture couldn't see it.
Right.
So...
And she didn't get the job because of it.
She did not get the job because of it. So one of the things that happens with intersectionality is that we begin to see the ways our different layers of privilege multiply or cancel each other out. And it goes both ways depending on whether it's a privilege or a lack of privilege in a particular situation.
Right. So in looking at, say, George's situation, how many layers of privilege would you see in that situation and strands of, as you say, you call them different strings.
Yes.
And then they kind of wrap around each other and multiply.
They
so,
do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we can think about, I also like to think of it as if you were a character in a role-playing game, you know, so you get this new game for Christmas and it's a role-playing game, and you get to roll dice for how many intelligence points and how many strength points, and you figure out all of your advantages. Well, in this particular game that we live in, you get bonus points if you just roll the dice to be male. And you get more bonus points if you're white and more bonus points if you're well-educated. And you get penalty points for being born female, for being middle-aged, for being a person of color, for being a sexual minority, so that before you even get out on the playing field that is our culture, just all of these different identity facets of who you are and how you look structure or limit the way you can move in our society.
Okay, this is where I'm going to go a little deep now. We're going to start to analyze some stuff here, because this is where I want to challenge that notion a little bit.
Okay, please do.
Yeah, okay, so, but I want to go to George on this one, because George, when I've spoken to you, you've stated that you really have always felt that you were privileged, and, well, okay, no. I mean, go ahead.
I never thought of myself as privileged. I never had to think about it. I mean, because I was privileged, I never had to think about where my next meal would come from and all those things.
Now, why did it? Do you think it took you as long as it did until retirement to go, whoa, I guess I must be privileged?
I don't really know. I really can't identify. Although I've had a lot of thinking about other kinds of things, and I thought a little bit about privilege and happiness. I don't know that those are related, really, because I think I mentioned to you, my wife and I and her son had a trip to India, and people in abject poverty sometimes seem to be happier, and so it's not privilege necessarily. The other thing that I know I've mentioned to you, I see myself as being privileged in that I'm not several things. For instance, I'm not Jewish. I don't have to worry about being attacked. I can go to my church and not worry about being shot. And so that's a whole lot of energy I don't have to consume in that kind of worry. And the same is true I didn't have to worry about my sexual identity being exposed. I could be myself. I never had to think about that. And so that's sort of a privilege of not being something, but still it's a privilege, and it allowed me to focus, not intentionally necessarily, but just, you know, my energy went into other things, not having to worry about what might happen if people found out. And so it's that sort of thing. Fairly early on, I was involved at the corporation I worked for in a corporate diversity council, and I was exposed to people that had sexual orientation concerns and that sort of thing. And that led me, I think, may have been when I started thinking about those things.
Right. And okay, so now this is where I'm going to challenge this notion as even being potentially a privileged notion in and of itself, that privilege is a thing. And what I mean by this is that if, and I've been on the side of privilege in the sense of monetary, so I'm going to just say monetary privilege. I'm also half white, so I get some privileges from that. But I've also been without money, and I've also been part brown. So I kind of walk in both worlds. I've been able at different times in my life to walk in both worlds. And in the no money Latin world, there are plenty of people that say, you know what? I don't want to be rich. I have no desire to be there. That is not a privilege I want. I like the privilege of enjoying my life, of having a life, of having a family. They're just a different set of priorities and in a sense, privileges from that world. And is our viewpoint of privilege in and of itself perpetuating the very thing we're trying to fight by acknowledging that we have privilege? Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you follow?
I think, I mean, if you don't realize you have privilege, then you don't think about that. And, you know, for most of my life, I didn't realize I had privilege. I was just some guy going through life, enjoying it, so I don't know. At some point, you and I talked a little bit about this earlier today, and that is, some people will privilege, isolates themselves from others. For instance, some people might feel shame from their privilege. Some people might sense that people are reluctant to come up and speak to them or approach them, and so they're isolated from maybe a group of people they'd like to have relationships with, but because of the privilege perceived by others, even if you don't recognize it in yourself, there is a barrier there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you think that goes both ways? As in, if you're privileged, say I'm white, I'm a white male privileged person, and I say white male upper class person, would then I also have difficulty melding with the lower class brown people of the world? Or, well, you know, could that...
Yeah, I think...
I don't want to say poor little
really,
rich kid. I'm not trying to
I
say
think
poor...
If you, yeah. I think if you... So when I was in divinity school, I was working with a social activist and a black preacher who was working in Roxbury. And in the class that we had, he looked at me on the far side of the room and he said, you know, you can walk anywhere in the city and no one will touch you. There was a, which didn't make any sense to me at the time. I had never thought about it. But his point was that I didn't even have to think about my own safety walking through the rough neighborhoods, because if anyone touched me, the entire police power would be brought out and forced and just pummel the neighborhood into submission.
Right.
So I could go and be as compassionate as I knew how and as present as I knew how and be completely clueless to this layer of cotton wool, this layer of protection that I didn't even know I had. So, yeah, I could go and have coffee and do my best to empathize and understand, but I did it with a complete lack of awareness of that part of my upbringing and that part of my life experience. And every other woman at the table whose skin was brown or whose skin was even darker than brown, they knew. They could see the shield around me, and they knew that I couldn't see it. So there was a very strange asymmetry there where my privilege advantaged me on one hand and put a barrier between my being able to really understand the life experiences of the other women in the room.
Yeah, yeah. There's no question it creates that barrier. And I think I'm still, let me go back to my question.
Okay.
Because what I'm saying is, by the from the educated standpoint of privilege, of what I would call white upper class privilege, be it male or female, there is a sense that, okay, we're the warm-hearted, you know, the bleeding heart liberal, okay, stereotype.
That would have been me.
Okay, bleeding heart liberal stereotype. And yet to those who are not part of that class, in some ways to there's a fine line between calling out privilege and saying, wow, I better recognize, yeah, I recognize I have it better than them, without sounding condescending.
So I have it different than them.
Okay.
And both of us are, and both of us are disadvantaged by the system.
There you go.
In different ways. And I didn't see how I was disadvantaged by the system.
Right.
And one of the things that happens is if you can stop occupying your identity as a male or a female or a white person or a brown person or whatever, if you can stop standing in your identity and start connecting person to person and deal with the relationship and deal with the misunderstandings and stick it out long enough, you actually start interacting person to person.
Yeah.
And when that happens, the hierarchy starts fracturing.
Right. Right.
And that, I think that's where you want to go.
That's where I'm going. Because sometimes the very concept of privilege perpetuates the hierarchy, the hierarchical notion of privilege, and I'm better than them, and I have it better than them, as opposed to I have it different. We have different lives, and one may not be better or worse, but they are different, and they have different values.
Yes.
And if we can begin to understand the value, and then you can begin to look at your life and say, you know, wait, maybe I'm not as quote-unquote privileged as I thought I was. Maybe there are some disadvantages to my so-called white upper class privilege, as in I'm disconnected from myself. I can't see people. I'm hugely invested in ego and accomplishments and accolades, because that's what this world is about, and that's what I have to be to survive in that hierarchical system, right?
Right.
And yet that cuts one off from just being real. And again, back to the notion of being flawed. And in some ways, people who aren't as high up on that, being flawed on that hierarchy, being flawed is part of being in your community. We're all flawed together. There's much greater, I would say, like in the Latin community, for example, there's a much greater acceptance of flaws. People lose it. They get out of control. They, you know, and then it's like, oh yeah, that happened and whatever, moving on, or it'll happen again, or maybe it won't. But from the white perspective, it could be seen as, oh, this is abusive, this is horrible, but from their perspective, in some ways, they're more forgiving of each other. There's more give and take of humanity, you know, to some degree. So I think that's like how the big question is, how do we reach a point where we begin to see each other?
Well, and so one of the things to realize is that you don't have to structure your world in a hierarchy. We've been, in the West, we inherited this notion of hierarchy from the ancient Greeks, and it got reified in medieval Christianity that, you know, you had God at the top and you went all the way down and you had the devil at the bottom and the good things were up high and you had the angels and then you had the guys and you had the all the different, you know, the women and the children were lower down the ladder, and then the animals, and that got pretty embedded in our culture. We got used to looking for it. When we started looking at evolution, the frame that Darwin looked through was one that said hierarchy is normal. So he looked for hierarchies, and that's what he found.
Right.
So one of the most important things that needs to happen in our time is to learn to see through different lenses, so that rather than looking for hierarchies, we start looking for webs and networks and ecosystems that where everything's related to everything else, and it's not necessarily related in a one-up way. All the pieces are important. All the participants are important.
Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
There's another dimension to this, and that sort of related. It has to do with culture, and that is the dominant society predominantly the Caucasians, the Europeans, believe that our cultural norms are what everybody should have,
right.
which discounts indigenous peoples and discounts Hispanics and all. I remember people used to get in football very upset with African American players celebrating a touchdown in the end zone. That's their culture. I mean, mm-hmm. and they ought to have a right to be able to operate within that culture,
right.
rather than applying our own, European standards to that.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of when I started to study anthropology in college, because that was where I initially wanted to go. And of course, it was all about let's go to other cultures and study them, yeah. and sort of how do they compare to us, the superior white man. And I was like, whoa, I'm out of here. I will not. This is not what I wanted to do.
No.
And quickly got out of that. And actually, ironically, ended up in theater, which was not really where I exactly wanted to go. But I was trying to go for a place where I wanted to find the human element, the commonality, the universal language that we all share, mm-hmm. right? And the human condition study of.
And theater, especially improv, you have to be fully present to the other person you are with.
Yeah.
It's incredible training.
Right.
For that practice of presence, which is the only thing that I've discovered anywhere that actually dismantles our projections.
Right.
What we're projecting on one another and lets us actually see each other.
Right.
Or experience
everything
right. for real.
Right. That is such a great way to put it, the word projection, because everybody's doing it from the bottom to the top. We're all projecting what we believe the other guy is or has, as opposed to, wait a minute, hold on. Maybe we're a lot more, equal than we think we are, or sharing in the same experience. And let's talk about... And whenever you guys want to open up the phone lines, we can do that. I'm going to start giving the number. It's 505-428-1382. We'll take a break in a second. But before we do, I think I wanted to talk about the hierarchy and the inherent shame that is sewn into the structure of the hierarchy and how that affects us.
Well, so back before Christmas, you interviewed Carol Gilligan and Naomi Schneider about their new book, Why Does Patriarchy Persist? And I was in the car and caught the second half of the interview and got all excited and ordered the book because I had this aha experience. It's like what they're talking about explains one of the riddles that I've been trying to figure out for years, which is why is it that every time we take a step toward greater inclusion, whether it's greater inclusion of women or greater inclusion of minorities or greater inclusion of LGBT people, every time we take a step, the resistance is so strong, it pops up over here more virulent than ever.
Exactly.
And what's going on? And as I was listening to the interview, I was thinking, so if hierarchy perpetuates itself by forcing those who are privileged to shut down their ability to feel compassion and empathy, because you would have to feel the suffering of all the people below you in the hierarchy. And that makes you just that much less human. You have to be perfect, but you can't feel, and you're not quite able to connect to people anymore.
Which we often refer to the folks at the top as the psychopaths. The ones who don't feel right in today's day and age.
Sure,
that's a very common,
And so then, on the other side, in order to fit in your role, whatever it is, as someone of the non-privileged class or the non-privileged gender or the non-privileged sexual identity, you have to not voice what you know is true. You have to separate yourself from your authentic experience because, as George was saying earlier, naming your authentic experience puts you at risk.
Yeah.
And so I was listening to this and I was thinking, oh my goodness, it isn't the color of your skin that's the problem. It isn't one's gender or one's sexual orientation. It's this hierarchical structure that we have imposed on the world because it's not actually there. It's a figment of our imaginations that we make real because we act as if it were true.
Exactly, exactly. It removes our ability to connect. Mm-hmm. To connect. And that's why, back to the, just to fill the listeners in a little bit on this patriarchy, why does patriarchy persist book and its theory, she talks about the still face baby experiment, and that's sort of where this lack is in the human being in the hierarchy is rooted. Why does patriarchy persist? Because and they say, well, and you can help me with this whole idea of the loss. But basically, if there's a still face baby experiment where the mother sits by the baby and the baby tries to engage at a number of levels, and when it gets no response, it has a variety of from the mother, because the mother has to have a still face and not respond.
It's a 2-minute experiment.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the video of the experiment, which is on YouTube, you can go find it, Google still face experiment. At the beginning, the baby and the mom are having this lovely, playful baby talk. The baby's, 18 months old or something. Interaction. And then the researcher says, okay, now make your face still for 2 full minutes.
To the mother, right?
And so the mother just gets really quiet and really still. And she maintains eye contact, but that's the only thing that she does. And so at first, the baby makes all the happy baby noises that got mom's attention and points and does all the cute things. And then when that doesn't get a response, starts to get agitated and squawks and squeals and flails around. And at the end of 2 minutes, the mom comes in and re-engages. And that re-engagement is what builds trust between the baby and the mom and allows the relationship to go on and the baby to be a whole human being as they grow up.
Right. And I have to add to this, because remember also they talk about if you continue the experiment and the mother continues to ignore the baby then goes to another level, which is to become depressed and turn in on itself, where it stops trying to connect.
It's like learned helplessness.
Yeah, yes.
And the baby gives up.
The baby gives up and turns in on itself and begins to become depressed. And if there's still no response there, the baby turns off the desire to connect in any way and reaches out to begin connecting to objects and things.
Right.
And so there's that lack of connection and the fear of reconnecting, because if we try to connect again, it could equal that rejection all over. It could rewound and replay that rejection.
Right.
So we fear the connection.
And the fascinating thing, of course, Carol Gilligan has done a lot of work both with little boys sort of entering kindergarten, first grade, and then with adolescent girls. And she says, in particular with the adolescent girls, when that connection starts to be broken, when they start being told you have to be a good girl, you have to conform to the stereotypes, you can't express the full experience of yourself as a whole person, first they protest. They act out. They get angry. And that's a really good sign. What they're doing, according to Gilligan, is trying to reestablish that loving relationship.
Yes.
And it is only, but the culture we're in says you don't respond.
Right.
You
right.
punish them when they do that. You don't withdraw. You withdraw.
That's right.
And it's only on the far side when they have completely detached from people and become good girls again.
Yeah.
That the society starts reinforcing and praising them.
Right.
And Gilligan doesn't do that, take the analysis outside of the gender roles. But I'm willing to bet the same thing happens in any of those hierarchies that our culture is built on.
Yep, absolutely. And the protesting, they equate the Me Too movement as
absolutely.
Women. And what I love about it is that at the root of what they're saying is, okay, and your words here today are, we're imposing this hierarchy onto the situation. But what they're saying is, underneath, what's always there is that desire to connect. We just have to get the attention of the baby again. We have to re-engage that baby from the material item it decided to attach itself to, which I thought was also
instead.
And what does that talk about? That's the analogy is that it's our consumer culture. So we go to things, to attach to things, and the more things we have, the more attention we get. So we're still seeking that connection, even when you think of it on that level, right?
But, yeah.
To some degree.
Yeah.
We're still seeking it. And so I love the idea that underneath it, the hierarchy is a simple truth that we are driven by the desire to connect.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that gives you hope.
Right.
Looking forward, gives me hope looking forward.
Right. Even at anger, that anger is that desire,
is a desire to connect.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, George, do you want to add anything to that?
No.
Okay. Well, guess what? We're going to take a break. I'm going to give you guys our number. I'd like to open up the phone lines. Let's see what people have to say. 505-428-1382. We haven't done phones in a long time, so hopefully we can get some callers. If not, we'll just keep up the conversation. 505-428-1382, and we'll be back after these short messages. And you are tuning into Dialogue, where the conversation starts with you, and we are changing that conversation. We do have someone on the line. I'm not sure they're ready to come on yet, but we're working on that. As soon as I get the go-ahead, we'll maybe put them on. They may just want to comment offline. Sometimes that happens. But, okay, I'm going to follow up here. George is busy taking that call with Gail about a concept of narcissism. We're going to take Carol Gilligan's theory even one step further. And this is the idea that just checking if we have a caller. Do we? No. Okay. So, again, I'll give out the number 505-428-1382, 505-428-1382. Back to this idea of the baby, the still baby experiment. In terms of attachment theory, from what I understand anyway, narcissism is born from that very lack of connection, of that attachment, right? And so the baby that searches for the material connection, the person that seeks that material connection would be identified as a narcissist later in life. Now, if you take it even one step...
Well, because rather than being able to see other people as people, they begin to see other people as objects.
As objects.
And it's when you see the other human beings around you as an object that you move to that point of being the narcissist.
Yes.
It's not just that you like books or sports equipment or fast cars.
Right.
It's that you've begun to see other human beings.
Right.
As its.
Right. Right. And in fact, there's a term they use in the narcissist world of narcissistic supply, that's what people become is narcissistic supply.
Mm.
Yeah. I reformulate that word and I say they're looking for validation, continual validation, though, because there's such an insecurity there that am I lovable? Am I lovable? Tell me, please tell me all the time. I need to know. So that's how I interpret that.
Okay.
But that's just my MK theory. But back to this narcissism, if you begin to look at, and there's tons of videos, it's like a subculture on YouTube. People start talking about narcissism, and I swear to God, it's just got this huge conversation going online. But they start talking about narcissistic abuse. And when you begin to look at the narcissist and its so-called victim, or he or she, the narcissist's victim, and the narcissistic abuse, what you see to me are the dynamics of subjugation. So if you want to look at the dynamics of subjugation and how to overcome subjugation, in many ways you can take the narcissist model and look at how do I survive the narcissist? How do I stand up to the narcissist? How do I voice myself against the narcissist? And it's kind of interesting. Anyway, it's very interesting when you look at the correlations because there are a lot of correlations.
And so
What are those ways?
Let's look and see if they map back on what Carol Gilligan's talking
about.
They
actually do. I have a friend.
Oh, cool.
I have a friend who's written an article about it.
Oh,
yeah. So
give me the reference afterwards.
I will, because they map up almost perfectly. It's and unfortunately I can't give them to you right now because I don't know
right.
them off the top
right.
of my head.
Right.
But I swear it's and so for me ideally I'm thinking that this is about having a language. I think it's about reestablishing a language of authenticity and the true self, and voicing that to the narcissist. I don't know that that's how you survive a narcissist, but and I don't even like the term narcissist too, because I think that stigmatizes. Yeah,
you know, but
I do have to identify. We've been asked to identify ourselves. My name is MK. I go by MK on the air, and joining me is Gail Mariner. She's a minister at the Universalist Santa Fe.
Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Santa Fe.
There you go. So
yeah,
if you're,
it's a mouthful.
There you, yeah. Now, and George is also joining us. George Weston. Do you want to add to that anything, George?
Only that I am also one of Gail's members of Gail's congregation, and also I work at KSFR.
There you go. I'm going to give the number out if somebody wants to join in on the conversation, 505-428-1382. And what were you going to say, Gail?
Oh, I don't remember.
We were talking about narcissism and
remember.
Yes.
One of the pieces of feminist theory that talks about looking at the patriarchy suggests that fighting the patriarchy head on is not going to work. It's going to reinforce those structures of privilege.
Right.
And so one of the strategies that I would take from Gilligan is that you need to start by building relationships that are peer relationships wherever you can find them. And in the early part of the women's movement, you know, women had consciousness-raising circles. We have support groups for folks who are dealing with any numbers of kinds of abuse, so that you begin to understand it isn't you.
Right.
So the first thing you have to reclaim, or the first thing that helps in reclaiming your voice or in reclaiming your sense of agency, is to be heard again and to have your experience validated, and then to begin to move laterally in the culture so that the foundations get pulled out from under the parts of the culture that are oppressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also means being vigilant in our own doctrine or code of ethics we've been given under the hierarchy to say, wait a minute, hold on, oops, there goes my need to compete.
I need to be perfect.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I was just speaking with some people. You look like you wanted to add something, George. No? And we were talking about just stigma at large, and they're on a no stigma campaign across the country, and they'll be on next week on Wake Up Call. Yeah, I'm hoping. Yeah. But they were saying, you know, the new word they use instead of saying, oh, awesome, they say, oh, flossom. And I love that idea, right? And again, the idea of fighting, once again, the minute you're fighting, you're engaging in the hierarchical type of activity, fighting.
So it's almost, to go back to the still-faced baby and the adolescent girl, you're trying to get the attention of the one you were in relationship. Even if it was a broken relationship, you were in relationship with the hierarchy, it's hurting you, you're going to try and move back into relationship. And that's just, if the relationship is wounding, then we need to find a different way to be in relationship.
Right, exactly.
And yes. So we need to create other kinds of spaces where we can be together, not one up and one down.
Exactly.
But as real peers, as what Martin Buber called in that I-thou relationship, that relationship where the holy in me honors the holy in you.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And even in terms of like romantic relationships, I often think of it as incompatibility or maybe just the wrong time for right now, as opposed to it just being this charged, oh, I'm rejected, oh, I'm nothing, oh, you know, giving up all hope. And it's like, wait a minute, hold on. Maybe it's reframing things a bit.
Right. Here. It wasn't the perfect fairy tale romance because that never existed. That's an artifact of that culture that says the prince needs to come and rescue the princess, and then they'll be happily ever after.
That's right.
Yeah. And, I mean, the media industry is still full of those stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the moments of becoming a woman of maturity is when you realize that, oops, oh, wait, my husband or my mate is not going to save me. He's as flawed as I am. Wait a minute, he might even need me more than I do him, you know? And when you realize that that's not going to happen, it's like, wait a minute, okay, now. And they say the same for growing up in terms of family, right? That it's,
right.
It's, oh, my parents aren't perfect. Oh, they're flawed. You know,
well, and then take it the next step. My school isn't perfect.
Right.
My organization isn't perfect.
Right.
My faith community has all the flaws that human beings have.
Right.
And that's okay.
Right.
Because if we're all imperfect, we probably need each other.
Exactly.
And we have the possibility of being fully alive.
Yes.
Because if you're perfect, the only things that can be perfect are things that are dead.
Yeah.
That's why saints don't get canonized for however many generations, because you have to make sure that they really were perfect.
Uh-huh. And that's interesting.
Yeah.
Got to test it out over time, right?
You have to see if you know, yeah. Scurrilous things surface that you didn't know about.
Yeah. Maybe we need a new saint of flaws.
That would work for me.
The imperfect saint. You know, another thing that they talk about in the world of narcissism and how to survive the so-called narcissists is observe, don't absorb. So when the attacks come, that it's observe, don't absorb, and that I think that sort of makes sense. You know, that okay, I'm not going to engage in, once again, what is it? It's a shaming dialogue usually.
So some of the companion mantra for that is, it's not about me.
Right, right.
So much of the time, our behavior is about what we are projecting on the person in front of us.
Right.
Rather than about what's really happening.
Yeah.
And so quite often when you're in those hurtful situations, it helps to say, okay, that's theirs.
Yeah.
That's their baggage. I don't have to own it. It's
right.
Not about me.
Right.
I might have been the trigger, but it's not about me.
Right. And even more so, even to begin to say it's the system that's causing that, even less than the person themselves.
Right.
Right.
And, well, so one of the things that's fabulous was just an epiphany for me in the work that Gilligan and Schneider are doing is that it reveals how men and women are equally broken. And it's much easier for me to have compassion for someone else I can see as wounded or as harmed by the system than it is for me to have compassion for someone I think has all the goodies and is up there in their perfect glass tower and has no clue of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think it's a real leveler to say, wait a minute, wherever there's a hierarchy, everyone in the hierarchy has been wounded, because that's the only way that the hierarchy can sustain itself.
Yeah. And shame is a huge piece of that damage. Mm-hmm. that is, and so again, back to the interactions, it certainly helps. The more I see, and I'm beginning to really hear this throughout a variety of people I talk to, whether it's in the criminal justice system or the mental health world or the political world in different capacities, but it's this idea that it's the system that's flawed and the inherent sort of underlying code or philosophy that drives that system. And even like Jordan Peterson is another one that's a big guy. Do you know about Jordan?
I don't.
Okay, but the manner in which he interacts, he's very defensive. And he says that patriarchy does not exist. And I want to say to him, but Jordan Peterson, you know, actually the manner in which you just said that is very patriarchal, because you just denied my reality on some levels. Why not say that, how does it, why not reframe this in a way that says the patriarchy is hurting me too? It exists and it's hurting everybody. That is a wholly different statement, and it's inclusive, not divisive, than saying patriarchy does not exist.
Well, when you say, as a male of some education and expertise, that patriarchy doesn't exist, what I hear is your privilege, your inability to, that's what George was talking about at the beginning.
Right.
You know, when you are wrapped in the cotton wool of privilege, and when you have had to slice off your ability to feel empathy with the people who are not in your shared cocoon, that's one of the markers that kind of sends up signal flares for folks at other parts of the pyramid.
Right. And here's another, again, I'm going to make another correlation with the narcissism. They talk a lot about gaslighting, and that's another form. To me, that statement is a gaslighting form of communicating.
Your reality isn't true.
Yeah, your reality. And so here's the challenge. How do we try to, because something that strikes me about privilege, and George and I were talking about this earlier, is that sometimes, literally, your neighbor, your family member, your friend is struggling right in front of you, and you won't even know it. You won't know it, and they may be struggling. Now, this could be, and I mean, we could say it could be a white privileged male that's struggling.
Absolutely.
And you don't see it. It could be a struggling person who has no money and or appears as if they have money but is too embarrassed. I mean, I've been there. I've been too embarrassed.
You pass.
Yeah, that's right. I'm too embarrassed to admit I don't have the money to pay for my meal right now, folks. So I'm just going to say that I already ate.
Right.
Right? Because there's a shame there. And or there's a shame of saying, gosh, I have too much privilege and I feel ashamed of this. There's an inherent guilt that in some ways I think also cements in the patriarchy even more, because if you feel so guilty for having so much, being wrong is even worse.
Well,
you know, on some level.
And.
Yeah.
And. Our culture, our cult of celebrity buys into this notion of prosperity gospel, which says that if you're on the top of the hierarchy, you're closer to perfect, you're closer to the Holy One, you are, and you were fated to be there.
Right.
You know, or you got there, whether you were fated to be there or you got there on your own, God approves.
Right.
And so if you're in that place and somehow you're not happy, if you're in that place and you're still suffering.
Right.
Then
who do you blame?
Well, who do you blame? But how do you
yourself is what I mean.
The risk in being vulnerable is huge.
Right.
The risk in being vulnerable is huge.
Right. The higher you climb, the higher the stakes are in terms of vulnerability. Yeah, yeah, that's so dead on. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. It's like inverted. The higher you climb, the more difficult it is to be wrong or imperfect. And it's like, wait a minute, what?
Because you're going to have to feel your feelings, right?
Yeah.
And in the model,
yeah,
that's the thing you had to give up in order to be up there.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a trap.
Yes, it is.
It's a trap, and it's so much fun watching people begin to explore other metaphors and other models of being in relationship.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just have to add this. Mm-hmm. You say it's a trap, and I would say also, yes, and a very effective means of reinforcement so that it does not die.
Right.
It will not die.
Right. It's self-perpetuating.
Just cements it in. Yeah, yeah. Didn't mean to. Anyway, keep going with it.
So one of the places that's the most interesting in terms of looking at alternatives to living on that great chain of being or staying on the hierarchy is the LGBT community. Because anytime you talk about getting off the binary, anytime you begin to explore all of the rainbow of possibilities in terms of human sexual identity and human relationship, suddenly that hierarchy is not there.
Yeah.
And so watching and being in conversation with LGBTQ people in my congregation and in the rest of the world that I inhabit,
yeah,
it's fascinating because they have moved enough out of sync with the gender binary hierarchy.
Right.
That whole different ways of experiencing the world seem to be unfolding or becoming a possibility.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it is interesting, too. I find myself as an old woman in engaging with this younger crowd that's open and out mm-hmm. about it all. It's like, wow, I'll find myself having sort of reactions that are like, wow, this is different. I have to adjust to this. How do I? And yet there's also freedom because I say, oh, yeah, I'm not female. Like, I'm female, but there's a lot of ways that I'm sort of not so female, and I don't look like Angelina Jolie.
The gender
I look a little
piece.
Like a, yeah. And I go, well, but I still like men, but I kind of look like a guy, but I'm not gay, you know. So sort of, but then I'm sort of going, and it's okay. I don't
so
have to wear makeup
to be,
and try to look like a woman anymore.
You just get to be MK.
I just get to be me now. It's great.
Because
I love it.
That set of stereotypes that falls on the hierarchy that were projected on you,
right,
have been shown to be just that,
yeah.
A set of stereotypes projected on you.
Exactly.
And you can choose whether or not you want to play with those stereotypes on any given day.
Yes, absolutely.
Or ever.
And you know what, George, we have 1 minute left, and we've been talking, and I'm thinking, George, what do you want to say? We have a minute left.
I've been listening. It's been great.
Do you feel any more connected or I don't know?
Well, these conversations are always so educational for me. I mean, it triggers thoughts and things that help my personal growth. So that's really, you know, one of the reasons why I enjoy this show. I enjoy talking to Gail.
Yeah, well, we enjoy talking to you.
We do.
it's a mutual thing.
So one of the most important things, one of the most important things Gilligan talks about is creating spaces of resonance where new voices can get heard.
Hallelujah.
And that's what happens here. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us today.